accession number 22342, reel 13.
Trooper Bowdler, reel 13. I was asking if you'd been able to keep in touch by any means with what was going on in Europe in general while you were...
Yes, well, our only means of communication was with the 19th in the tank.
19 set, yes. Yes,
that's it, was a model 19th.
Right.
And in certain instances we could get the BBC, amazingly.
Mm.
And by putting the telephones into a saucepan or a bowl, it acted as a sound amplifier.
Loudspeaker. Mm.
So it, yes, that's right. And so we used to sit on the top of the turret listening to the... Well, the sounds, you see. But the first we heard of the victory in Europe was not through that. I think probably at the time we were... The signal couldn't reach us.
Mm.
We couldn't get the signal.
What did you do for overnight stops when you were going through this deep jungle?
Yes, slept with the tank, on the tank, on the back of the tank.
Mm.
Nothing else you could do, really.
Because there were just the 12 of you, weren't there?
Yes.
The 12 drivers and your lieutenant.
Yes, that's right.
And
yes. There might have been a few odd bods as well, but...
Yes.
I can't remember them. All I know is there were 12 drivers and we had one man in charge who was a lieutenant. And I can't even remember his name.
Mm.
But he did the job very well. He obviously had it all mapped out and our contacts were there. He handled the Chinese situation quite well, I thought. I wouldn't have cared to be in his position during the exchange. So... And on the whole, it was a pretty successful expedition. The only thing is that it failed.
What happened? How did it fail?
It failed because the speed of the advance down the south outpaced us and we could never catch up with them. So...
You were the reinforcement that didn't arrive in time.
Absolutely. Mm. We were there to make up the losses.
Yes.
That sustained.
Mm. What sort of distance could you travel in a day?
Oh,
this journey.
You would be amazed when I tell you that I have recorded in my diary at the time that it took us all day to go a mile and a quarter.
What went wrong? Why was it so difficult?
Streams, chunks, things like that.
Mm. Just crossing obstacles.
Bashing your way through. Mm. Obstacles, yes. Sheer physical obstacles. And having to circumnavigate things, you know, hazards and things like that. Really dreadful driving conditions. And I mean, even if we'd got the tanks down there, they would have been wrecked by the time we got them there.
Did they suffer damage on the way then?
Well, of course they did. Yeah. And we tore the guts out of them.
What sort of things went wrong with them?
There wasn't a great deal went wrong with them. It was just wear and tear. I mean, we were revving these things up like the clappers, you know. And they can only take so much of that.
Mm.
And the tracks themselves, I mean, they're under terrific strain, especially going through that sort of country.
What sort of country was it? Thick jungle.
Thick jungle, with just dirt tracks through it.
Mm.
No roads. The only vestige of a road was the one that went down through the gorge. We had to... That was a bit like climbing the pass in reverse.
Mm.
We went down like this, crossed a raging torrent at the bottom, and zigzagged all the way back up the top. And it was a very similar experience to climbing the pass.
On this journey, did you ever come across any Japanese?
Dead ones.
Dead ones?
Yes.
Not live ones?
No.
Mm.
Definitely. There were live ones about. There were bands. We were warned about it. There were bands. I mean, we did our normal guard duties, you know.
Turret guards.
Out of the 12 of us, we did our stint, and the others could sleep while you stood on guard, and then you had your turn and you got a kit. So it was properly handled and supervised. But as I say, by the time we got to a place called Mamia, the tanks were really thoroughly knackered, if I may use the phrase.
Yes.
I mean, they were really worn out. We'd given them a hell of a bashing. Yes, Lashio, when we ended up at Mamia, which was a lovely little Burmese town, and hadn't got badly damaged, and it had Anglo-Burmese in it, who were very, very friendly, and greeted us. And we invited them onto our tanks to have a look at them and all the rest of it. And we questioned them about the occupation and how they got on with the Japs. And they told us some pretty alarming stories, you know, rape and all that sort of thing. And, Mamia itself had been untouched by the war, funnily enough. It had never been sort of hit by our forces. The Japs had just pulled out. And it was really our first taste of civilization. They had a club there. I suppose it was from the old days of the Raj, you know, where they had their club and the swimming pool there and everything. Lovely. There were no booze other than arak, you know, rice wine. You could get rice wine. But the people there were most friendly. They invited us down there and we had this. The swimming pool was put at our disposal. We invited them up to come and look at the tanks, and that was it. Anyway, the local commander in the district said that was it. The tanks weren't allowed to move anymore because we were on metalled roads then, and we were beginning to ruin the roads, you know, with our manoeuvring. So he said no. And in any case, we'd never get to the front on time to do any serious damage because A, they would have needed a pretty major overhaul, and B, the advance had gone way ahead of us.
They'd outpaced you.
Outpaced us completely.
What about the Burmese as such, the pure Burmese? Did you have anything to do with them?
Yes, we did.
How did you get on with them?
Quite well. I like the Burmese. I like them very much. Although, apparently, in later life, I mean, long after I left, the whole country went to the dogs, didn't it? But the Burmese that I met, and the Anglo-Burmese, were extremely friendly people, and they appeared to be gentle, really nice people. And you could relate to them because they had a lighter skin and all the rest of it. It's rather weird, really, but they seemed a bit more like us, if you know what I mean.
More in common.
Yes, they had more in common with us, and we got on quite well with them.
What did you do with these tanks then? You were told at Mamio they couldn't go any further.
That's
so
right.
Did you just have to abandon
them?
Yes,
yeah. So we abandoned them, and we were given trucks, 3 tonners, and we made our way south through towns that had just been taken, and one of them was Mandalay. We pulled into Mandalay.
What condition was Mandalay in when you saw it?
Goodness. I would never have believed it unless I'd seen it. The fort, the Red Fort, had walls about 20 foot thick, and of course the Japs were behind them. But when you think that we breached those walls and attacked and got inside them and took the town, says a lot for the army. But we did. I didn't have any part in that battle, but it had just been finished when we got there, and there were still Japanese dead all over the place, and the town itself was a ruin. It was dreadful to see. It really was a ruin, and for the first time I saw the effect of flamethrowers. There were a number of Japanese held up in a, I don't know what it was. It was a sort of monument with a sort of hollow space underneath, and they got in there, and they were killed in there. And they were all laying there dead, and they were badly, very badly burned. And I thought, what a terrible thing to be in a place like that and have fire squirted at you. Must be awful. But from Mandalay onwards, I mean, it was the advance went on at breakneck speed. I mean, there's a thing that always annoys me about records of the Burma campaign, and that is that the historians, or whoever they are, say that the first Japanese defeat at the hands of the British was at Kohima and Imphal, which is true. It was a defeat, quite a significant defeat, but it wasn't the first one. We were the first time the Japs had ever had to retreat. They hit the box and that was it. They could not conquer it, and we went on the offensive from the box, and we had them on the retreat. So we were the first people to run a successful campaign against the Japs. Here comes a heavy rain. So yes, that annoys me a bit. Better shut the door. Oops.
So you were still moving as a small party
with
your lieutenant in charge. Yes. Where were you heading for when you went through Mactilla and Mandalay?
We were headed to Mactilla, to the airport.
Yes.
To get flown out. And Mactilla itself was in a bit of a mess. That was thoroughly blown to pieces. But eventually we found our way to there and handed over our vehicles. And we boarded a plane from Mactilla and back to Camilla, I think.
Was the regiment still at Camilla?
The regiment was in Coconada.
They were in Coconada?
Yeah. Well, miles, hundreds of miles away. So we had to make our way back, first to Calcutta, through Mactilla. I think it was Mactilla, Camilla, and then Calcutta, and then by train from Calcutta to Coconada, and that was the end of our little adventure.
What were they doing when you got back? Were they still training for an amphibious assault?
Yes, they were. But soon after that, I think it was, I think the bomb got dropped, and they realised that a costly invasion wasn't going to be necessary. And we were stood down. They kept their equipment. They kept the DD tanks. But I was. They started repatriating people, and I was repatriated.
What were your thoughts when you heard about the atomic attack on Japan?
Well, I didn't know much about the details. I knew that this powerful weapon had been dropped, and that it had, you know, the Japs had given in. And I thought, well, thank God for that, because knowing what fanatical fighters they were, having had experience of, any invasion would have been very, very costly indeed. Wherever you met them, you know, I mean, they'd fight to the last man, and you'd have lost an awful lot of people trying to take Japan. An awful lot of people. Even the islands. I mean, the Americans used to blast these islands to pieces before they ever went in to attack them. They used to stand offshore and pepper them with heavy guns, naval guns, and they still got beat up when they went onshore. And I'm sure the same would have been true of us if we'd have tried to do it. So it was one of relief, really.
Was that the general feeling in the regiment, do you think?
Oh, yes. Yes. Yes.
Why was it, do you think, that you were chosen for repatriation? Was it because of your length of service overseas, or was it because you'd been in action, or because you'd been injured by the stingray?
No, that was nothing to do with it. No, I think the reason, my number was up.
Your number was up?
Yeah, I think my number was up, and it was first come, sort of first served. The people who were earliest out were the earliest repatriated. And I was lucky. We had to go to a transit camp in what the devil's the name of it? Not on the opposite side of the country to Calcutta. Gone.
Bombay?
No. It's the same side as Bombay, but up
Madras?
North. Oh, no. Karachi.
Karachi, yes. Mm.
So we had to go to Karachi and join a huge transit camp there. I shall never forget it. This enormous transit camp. How they fed everybody, I do not know.
Mm.
And from there, we put on board a converted Liberator bomber and flown home all the way in this one aircraft.
Mm.
We came across Arabia, of course. First port of call, first stop was Tel Aviv.
Mm.
We landed at Tel Aviv. Then from Tel Aviv to North Africa, Castel Benito, we landed there. From Castel Benito, we flew across the Med to Marseille, and from Marseille to England, and we landed in England.
How long did that journey take altogether?
Well, it was a long, long journey. Of course, there were breaks in it, obviously. We were in Tel Aviv for several days. I really couldn't tell you. I suppose I've got it in my diaries, but the whole how long the trip took.
What did you do while you were in Tel Aviv? Were you?
Well, we went to cafes and things like that. I remember the Cafe Raimon. We went to, which had some gorgeous girls, because we'd never seen any. I mean, it's amazing how I was out there 4 years in India and Burma, and in Burma and India, the Far East, you never saw a pram. Kids were always carried on the hip,
yeah,
or on the back, and you never saw a pram. You never saw a woman in anything other than the traditional dress, saris and things like that. Men too, no suits and that sort of thing. It's different now, of course, but in those days, you lost all touch with that sort of thing. And it was really quite a culture shock. I shall never forget when I landed in England and got on the train. And I remember looking out of, I think it was October time. And to me it was damn cold, you know, jolly cold. And I looked out and there was these fit, healthy looking women pushing kids in prams. The kids looked healthy, and it was, to me, bitterly cold, and they were in sort of lightweight clothing.
Mm.
And I thought, gosh, they're a hardy race. But, yes, it was quite a contrast. And not having seen that sort of thing for years, to suddenly confront it again when you come home, it's quite a shock.
Did you get any sense of the political atmosphere in Palestine when you were in Tel Aviv?
No, I didn't. I knew there was trouble in the offing, but it didn't offend us, didn't affect us, and we were quite friendly with the local population, you know. I didn't get involved with any of the girls or anything like that, because I had Betty here, she was my girlfriend at the time. We weren't married, but she was my friend when I went out there, and she was still my friend when I came back.
Had you managed to keep in touch while you
were? Oh, yes, she was writing letters.
And the mail came through both
directions.
Eventually
it got to you, yes, months late, but there, nevertheless it got to me.
Mm.
And I remember my mother sending me a cake out. I used to get mail from her, and she thought I'd like a cake, either on my birthday or Christmas or something like that. And this cake arrived. Well, it was in a box. It looked pretty battered. Postmarks and stamps all over it. And I opened it up, and it was a lovely fruit cake, but it was rotten.
Oh.
It had been hanging around so long in humid atmosphere.
Mm.
It was uneatable, which was a dreadful shame, you know. Mm. I never told her that.
So you got back to England. What happened to you once you arrived back in England?
I think we went to Bovington camp to start with. Our tropical kit was taken off us, and we were issued with blighty kit, and we were sent on disembarkation leave, given travel warrants, and sent home. And I think I had a month of disembarkation leave, and which I thoroughly enjoyed. Renewed old acquaintances, and what happened then? Oh yes, we.
Were you the only member of the 25th Dragoons who'd been sent back in this party, or were there other members of the regiment with you?
Oh, there were other regiments, other members of the regiment, yes, yes. But you gradually got split up, if you know what I mean, because you went to different barrack rooms or different this, that and the other, you know. And
you dispersed on the way back.
Yes, you actually dispersed. And you'd mention 25th Dragoons and people would say, who are they?
Yes.
But, no, it's very nice to meet anyone that was from the old regiment. But from embarkation leave, they decided that as we'd had battle experience, we would be very useful serving in the OCTA, Officer Training Unit, down at Bovington. So that's where I was sent for the rest of my service.
What job were you doing there?
Driving. And I drove. I had some of the best driving experiences ever, because I got to drive the latest. pardon me. The latest at that time was the Comet. And the Comet could go like stink. It was a lovely tank. Beautiful suspension, you know, and it could really go. It was a real, it was a joy to drive. And so we used to go out on Bovington Plains and that sort of thing, on the mud tracks. And they've got some pretty severe country down there to test tanks on, you know, like that.
Up and down, like yes.
Through mud. And, yes, and... it was a real joy to drive them, and these guys were given. They were being put through sort of tactical instructions how to get hull down and the stuff that we'd done years ago. You know,
was it essentially the same sort of things you'd done in your earlier training? Had there been any?
No, it's basically the same thing, but at a higher level.
Yes,
from a command level. Which included everything we did, but then there was more on top of it. In other words, telling people what to do and how to do it and all the rest of it.
But has there been any change in basic principles or procedures since your time of doing that?
No.
No. So it's still the same kind of thing?
Still the same. And still no anti-aircraft instruction, which amazed me, you know, when you think of the importance of aircraft and anti-aircraft measures.
I thought they'd have learned by that time.
Absolutely vital, in my view. You know. But there you go. You don't think of these things until afterwards. It's in, on reflection that you think about it. Didn't occur to me at the time.
How were you treated down there as, on the instructional staff? Was
with
it
great respect.
A happy place to work.
Oh, yes. With great respect. All these cadets called you staff. You were called staff, and you could tell them what you wanted them to do to a certain extent. And if there was anything wrong, if they did anything wrong, it was expected that you would put them right in a gentle way, of course, not shout and bawl or anything like that, but just say, you know, you're doing that all wrong, sort of thing, you know. I can't go in there, or this and the other, you know. And don't forget we're exposed, stuck up here on top of this ridge and all that sort of thing, you know. So, yes, it was. I enjoyed my life down at Bovington. It was a good posting. And you were with nice people, intelligent people. And course, poor devils, half of them, they wouldn't get any... They would never be able to use their training at all, because things were being wound down, you know. So it was all rather a shame for them. Anyway, one can only hope that they enjoyed their bashing across the moors. Because it was rather fun, you know. I mean, taking a great big lumbering tank across at high speed and that sort of thing. And firing. They did firing practice and all that sort of thing. And we used to do a lot of schemes where they used thunder flashes. And then go around chucking thunder flashes at each other. That sort of thing. I think they thoroughly enjoyed it.
Did you think of turning regular and staying in the army?
No, I couldn't get out quick enough. I just could not get out quick enough. I'd had a gutful of it. I certainly didn't want any more fighting. And, I thought the services, or the army, let's say the army, because that's what we're talking about, was, you know, all a bit juvenile. I could not put up with this idea that you were an ignoramus and the people that were above you had all the knowledge and the wisdom. But that was very much the case. I mean, there were people who'd, I don't know how they got promoted, but they did. And there were NCO. With officers, it wasn't too bad because there was a class with officers. I mean, officers came from a certain class of people. I think what they did when people joined the services was to say, what job did you do? Now, if you were a banker, if you worked in a bank, or if you were a solicitor in the legal profession, or if you were a company manager or something like that, then you were officer material. And you went to OCTU, and you were trained as an officer. Nothing wrong with that. You obviously took leadership. You had to take leadership decisions in your business. And therefore, you naturally assumed you could do the job. And the trouble wasn't with the officers, it was more with the NCOs. And NCOs seemed to be made up of the most ignorant people on earth, you know. The sort of thing, you'd get a sergeant or even a sergeant major, and he would come outside and he'd, now I'm going to segregate you. He had no clue what he was talking about. He didn't know what the word meant, or they used to use words that they didn't know the meaning of and use them in the wrong place and all that sort of thing. And you thought, how the hell did these guys, and they're telling me what to do, you know, and it rankled. I didn't like it. And I could put up with the rest of the army, but some NCOs, of course, they weren't all like that, but some of the NCOs were absolute ignoramuses. And to be told what to do by an ignoramus doesn't go down very well.
What happened then when you were discharged? What was the procedure?
Well, to start with, you went down to Wool, the local village, and have a thunderous great booze up.
Yes, of course.
About it.
That's the most important of them, boy.
Absolutely, yeah. And chucked a few thunder flashes around, you know, and generally behaved pretty badly. But then you were given your discharge papers, and a gratuity, I seem to recall. I don't know what the gratuity was now. It was a pitiful amount, anyway. Can't even remember what it was for. And you were also given a demob suit, a suit of clothing. Which, you know, on the face of it, it got you started in civil life again. So,
what, was it difficult to adjust back to civilian life and being in uniform?
Yes, very difficult. And not only that, I was raw from what I'd been through. And the sound of a train whistle, which they used to do quite a lot in those days, would have me jumping out of the skin, you know.